This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where, in just a few minutes, President Bush is expected in the Brady briefing room at the White House to hold a news conference. There's been a lot of gloomy economic news this past week, and the president's press office tells us to expect an opening statement to address housing, among other issues. But there could also be questions about fears of inflation. The cost of oil and food are rising quickly. And about the sluggish economic growth that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke spoke of to Congress yesterday. Together, those could combine into the term stagflation, which was last used to describe the unhappy economic circumstances of 30 years ago. The president can also be expected to scold Congress for failure to pass a new electronic surveillance bill that he will sign. The bill approved by the House does not include retroactive protection for telephone companies that provided the government access to calls and emails without a warrant. And the president can expect questions on Iraq, Afghanistan, the aftermath of the elections in Pakistan, Fidel Castro's decision to step down as president of Cuba, the declaration of independence by Kosovo, and, not unrelated, this weekend's elections in Russia. It's possible he could also be asked about the Navy missile that struck a dead reconnaissance satellite in orbit last week and whether that was a message to China. With me here in the studio are NPR's intelligence correspondent, Tom Gelton. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Neil.
And with us from Capitol Hill is NPR's congressional correspondent, David Wella. And it's nice to speak with you.
Good morning, Neil.
And Tom, I guess an issue uppermost in the president's mind today is that intelligence law, which has not been reauthorized by Congress.
Neil, President Bush has spoken about this almost every day now for the last 2 weeks, making it very clear that it is a top priority. And it's also an issue that has a lot of political resonance. The Republicans are speaking out on this every day. They see it as an issue on which the Democrats are vulnerable. I can say, Neil, that from the standpoint of the intelligence community, this is a very top priority. The kind of surveillance authority that they are looking for, they are vital to the counterterrorism fight. On the other hand, as I say, it's got a political side to it, and I think that the Democrats, many Democrats, David can speak to this, are annoyed that it has been politicized to the extent it has.
And David Wellner, where does this stand right now in Congress?
Well, it stands in the sense that both the Senate and the House have passed bills that would update the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and in a sense, make almost permanent for 4 years or 6 years, a temporary law that was passed back in August. But the big difference is that the Senate bill does have this retroactive immunity for the phone companies. The House bill does not. And House Democrats proposed, as did Senate Democrats, to extend the temporary law months ahead or even a year ahead while they worked out their differences. This was opposed by Republicans in both chambers. And so there's a bit of a bind when Republicans are saying that this is very dangerous, that this law has now expired, and at the same time they refuse to extend the law. I went to a winter meeting of the Republican National Committee in January where Karl Rove spoke, and he said that this is an issue that Republicans should be running on this year, and it would be one that he thought would be a winner for them. So there's a lot of suspicion by Democrats that this is more political than it is about intelligence.
And another issue that's become highly political, another of the measures introduced in Congress to cut funding for the Iraq war, start bringing troops home. And this time, David Wellner, the Republicans went along with it. They're happy to discuss the war in Iraq right now.
Well, they're happy to discuss it. I think they feel that the surge has worked out far better than even many of them expected it would. And they think that this discussion of Iraq was really not meant by Democrats to go on for very long. It keeps by having this debate on Iraq, it keeps a bill that would give courts a say over the terms of people's mortgages off the Senate floor. This is something that the White House opposes. And in a sense, we're having an extended debate over legislation that nobody in the Senate chamber thinks has a prayer of being passed.
And Tom Gelton, one other issue that may come up is the Turkish incursion into the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq. Again, this is Iraqi sovereign territory. The Turks are there in pursuit of guerrillas of the PKK, a Maoist outfit that has been launching, described as a terrorist group by the United States and others, that's launching cross-border attacks into Turkey. Just today, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, said to Ankara, this should be very short days, not weeks.
That's right, Neil. The United States knew about this incursion ahead of time and essentially gave it a yellow light, if not a green light. Nevertheless, it does make the U.S. government very nervous. And Secretary Gates, as you say, is urging the Turks to pull out. But now that they're in there, they've made it clear that they're only going to leave when they have accomplished their military mission. And they have a very challenging military mission, trying to eradicate those PKK guerrillas in that very remote, rugged area where those guerrillas have been fighting for years and where they know the terrain very well. So this has the potential of being a kind of a sore spot, a sore point in U.S.-Turkish relations. Will be interesting to see what the president says about it.
There are also developments politically in Iraq, where yesterday the Iraqi Presidential Council rejected a measure that would have set up provincial elections, which is one of the benchmarks, one of the key issues that the U.S. Congress and U.S. leadership have been asking for from the Iraqi government thus far. Nevertheless, a speech today by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki from Karbala on a major religious holiday there in Iraq, saying things are going very well in that country. He was talking about reconciliation. Here's the president.
Good morning. Laura and I, as you know, recently came back from Africa, where we saw firsthand how the emergency plan for AIDS relief is saving lives. I had a chance to go to speak to the Sullivan Foundation the other day about our trip. And the reason I did so was to remind the American people about how important it is for our nation to remain generous and compassionate when it comes to helping people overseas. I also, during my trip, urged Congress to reauthorize the emergency plan and increase our commitment, and they did. They approved a good bipartisan bill that maintains the principles that have made this program effective. And so I want to thank Acting Chairman Howard Berman and Ranking Member Ileana Ross Lathian and all the members of the committee for the action they took. This afternoon they're going to come down, and I'll be able to thank them in person, and I'm going to brief them on the trip. Obviously the hope is now that the House will act quickly and send the bill reauthorizing PEPFAR to the Senate, and I'd like to sign into law as quickly as possible. Members should also act on a very urgent priority, and that is to pass legislation our intelligence officials need to quickly and effectively monitor terrorist communications. At issue is a dispute over whether telecommunications companies should be subjected to class action lawsuits because they are believed to have helped defend America after the attacks of 9/11. Allowing these lawsuits to proceed would be unfair. If any of these companies helped us, they did so after being told by our government that their assistance was legal and vital to our national security. Allowing the lawsuits to proceed could aid our enemies, because the litigation process could lead to the disclosure of information about how we conduct surveillance, and it would give al-Qaeda and others a roadmap as to how to avoid the surveillance. Allowing these lawsuits to proceed could make it harder to track the terrorists, because private companies besieged by and fearful of lawsuits would be less willing to help us quickly get the information we need. Without the cooperation of the private sector, we cannot protect our country from terrorist attack. Protecting these companies from lawsuits is not a partisan issue. Republicans and Democrats in the United States Senate came together and passed a good bill protecting private companies from these abusive lawsuits. And Republicans and Democrats in the House stand ready to pass the Senate bill. If House leaders would only stop blocking an up or down vote and let the majority in the House prevail. Some in Congress have said we have nothing to worry about because if we lose the cooperation of the private sector, we can use the old FISA law. Well, they're wrong. FISA was out of date. It did not allow us to track foreign terrorists on foreign soil quickly and effectively. And that is why a dangerous intelligence gap opened up last year. And that is why Congress passed legislation that reformed FISA. But they did so only temporarily. The law expired. The threat to America has not expired. Congress understood last year that FISA did not give our intelligence professionals the tools they needed to keep us safe. The Senate understands that the FISA, old FISA, didn't give us the tools needed to protect America. The bipartisan bill it passes provides those tools our intelligence professionals need. Yet the House's failure to pass this law raises the risk of reopening a gap in our intelligence gathering, and that is dangerous. Another vital priority for protecting the nation is prevailing in Iraq. Unfortunately, this week the Senate debated yet another bill that threatens to cut off funding and tie the hands of our commanders in Iraq. It seems that no matter what happens in Iraq, opponents of the war have one answer: retreat. When things were going badly in Iraq a year ago, they called for withdrawal. Then we changed our strategy, launched the surge, and turned the situation around. Since the surge began, high-profile terrorist attacks are down, civilian deaths are down, sectarian killings are down, and our own casualties are down. U.S. and Iraqi forces have captured or killed thousands of extremists, including hundreds of key al-Qaeda operatives and leaders. Reconciliation is taking place in local communities across the country. That reconciliation is beginning to translate into political progress in the capital city. In the face of these changes on the ground, congressional leaders are still sounding the same old call for withdrawal. I guess you could say that when it comes to pushing for withdrawal, their strategy is to stay the course. It's interesting that many of the same people who once accused me of refusing to acknowledge setbacks in Iraq now are the ones who are refusing to acknowledge progress in Iraq. If we follow their advice a year ago, Iraq would be far different and more dangerous place than it is today. And the American people would be at greater risk. If we follow their advice now, we would put at risk the gains our troops have made over the past year. Congress does need to act when it comes to Iraq. What they need to do is stand by our brave men and women in uniform and fully funded troops. Finally, Congress needs to act to help homeowners avoid foreclosure. Fortunately, the Senate is considering legislation that would do more to bail out lenders and speculators than to help American families keep their homes. The Senate bill would actually prolong the time it takes for the housing market to adjust and recover, and it would lead to higher interest rates. This would be unfair to the millions of homeowners who make the hard choices every month to pay their mortgage on time, and it would be unfair to future home buyers. Instead, Congress should move ahead with responsible legislation to modernize the Federal Housing Administration and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. By taking these steps, we can help struggling homeowners and help our economy weather the difficult time in the housing market. We're glad to take some questions. Kerry.
Mr. President, bad economic news continues to pile up. The latest today with the GDP barely growing. Are you concerned that a sagging economy and hard times will help defeat John McCain like it did your father in 1992? And how far are you willing to go to prevent that?
I'm concerned about the economy because I'm concerned about working Americans, concerned about people who want to, put money on the table and save for their kids' education. That's why I'm concerned about the economy. I want Americans working. And there's no question the economy has slowed down. You just cited another example of slowdown. I don't think we're headed to recession, but no question we're in a slowdown. And that's why we acted, and acted strongly, with over $150 billion worth of pro-growth economic incentives, mainly money going into the hands of our consumers, and some money going to incent businesses to invest, which will create jobs. And so we acted robustly, and now it's time to determine whether or not this pro-growth package will actually work. Now, the checks will start going out in the second week of May. The There's going to be letters out soon explaining who's eligible for the refunds. Credit will happen in the first week of May. Some people will choose to have their bank accounts credited. And in the second week of May, we anticipate the checks, you know, start moving out of Washington. And the purpose is to encourage our consumers. Purpose is give them money, their own to begin with, by the way, but give them money to help deal with the adverse effects of the decline in housing value. Consumerism is a significant part of our GDP growth, and we want to sustain the American consumer, encourage the American consumer, and at the same time, we want to encourage investment. So we'll see how the plan works. So,
political context.
No, you're trying to get me to be the pundit again. Look, you all figure that out. I mean, what I'm dealing with is a situation at hand, and I appreciate that both the Democrats and Republicans in the United States Congress and Senate for getting this bill done very quickly. And it's a substantial piece of legislation, and it's a good sign that we can figure out how to cooperate with each other at times. And so we'll see the effects of this pro-growth package. It's I know there's a lot of, here in Washington, people are trying to, stimulus package 2 and all that stuff. Why don't we let stimulus package 1, which seemed like a good idea at the time, have a chance to kick in?
Mr. President, Turkey's ground offensive in northern Iraq is now a week old with no end in sight. How quickly would you like to see Turkey end its offensive, its incursion? And do you have any concerns about the possibility of protracted presence in northern Iraq causing further destabilization in the region?
A couple of points on that. One, the Turks, the Americans, and the Iraqis, including the Iraqi Kurds, share a common enemy in the PKK. And secondly, it's in nobody's interest that there be safe haven for people who are have the willingness to kill innocent people. Second point I want to make to you, Matt, there is a special forces presence in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan now, apart from what you're referring to. So there is a presence, and there has been a presence for a while. Thirdly, I strongly agree with the sentiments of Secretary Gates, who said that the incursion must be limited and must be temporary in nature. In other words, it shouldn't be long-lasting. The Turks need to move quickly, achieve their objective, and get out.
But how quickly, sir, do they need to move out?
As quickly as possible.
Days or weeks?
Well, as possible.
Mr. President, I'd like to ask you about Russia. The Democratic candidates, when asked about the new Russian leader, Dmitry Medvedev, didn't appear to know a great deal about him. I wonder what you can say about him. How much power you think he's really got with Putin still in the picture? And critics would say you badly misjudged Vladimir Putin. Mm. So what would be your cautionary tale to your successor about the threat Russia poses and how to deal with this new leader?
I don't know much about Medvedev either. And what'll be interesting to see is who comes to the who represents Russia at the G8, for example. It'll be interesting to see. It'll help, I think, give some insight as to how Russia intends to conduct foreign policy after Vladimir Putin's presidency. And I can't answer the question yet. I can say that it's in our interest to continue to have relations with Russia. For example, on proliferation matters, it's in our interest to be able to, make sure that, materials that could cause great harm aren't proliferated. It's in our interest to work together on Iran. As I said, I think in this room the last time I was here, I appreciated the fact that Vladimir Putin told the Iranians that Russia will provide enriched uranium to run the Bashir power plant, thereby negating the need for the Iranians to enrich in the first place. Thought that was a constructive suggestion. And we need to be in a position to be able to work with Russia on Iran. There's a lot of areas where yesterday, for example, with the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, I talked about a missile defense system in Europe, but I believe it's in our interests to try to figure out a way for the Russians to understand the system is not aimed at them, but aimed at the real threats of the 21st century, which could be a launch from a violent regime, a launch of a weapon of mass destruction. So there's areas, Dave, where we need to cooperate. And let me finish. And so I'm going to try to leave it so whoever my successor is will be able to have a relationship with whoever's running foreign policy in Russia. It's in the country's interest. That doesn't mean we have to agree all the time. I mean, obviously, we didn't agree on Kosovo. There will be other areas where we don't agree. And yet, it is in the interest of the country to have a relationship leader to leader, and hopefully beyond that.
First of all, are you suggesting or are you worried that, in fact, Medvedev is a puppet for Vladimir Putin?
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't. That's your conclusion, not mine.
I'm asking the question about whether you're concerned. But isn't there something you took away and you can offer to your successor about how it's risky in the process of sizing up your Russian counterpart? Don't you think
Here's what I learned. I learned that it's important to establish a personal relations with leaders, even though you may not agree with them. Certain leaders. Now, I'm not going to have a personal relationship with Kim Jong-il. And our relationships are such that that's impossible. But U.S.-Russian relations are important. It's important for stability. It's important for our relations in Europe. And therefore, my advice is to establish a personal relationship with whoever is in charge of foreign policy in Russia. It's in our country's interest to do so. Now, it makes it easier, by the way, when there's a trustworthy relationship, to be able to disagree and yet maintain common interests in other areas. And so we've had our disagreements. As you know, Putin's a straightforward, pretty tough character when it comes to his interests. Well, so am I. And, we've had some headbutts, diplomatic headbutts. You might remember the trip to Slovakia. I think you were there at the famous press conference. But, and yet, in spite of that, our differences of opinion, we still have got a cordial enough relationship to be able to deal with common threats and opportunities. And that's going to be important for the next president to maintain. Yeah, Jonathan.
Mr. President,
yeah,
do you believe if we had the kind of rapid pullout from Iraq that the Democrats are talking about, that we'd be at greater risk of a terrorist attack here at home? And when Senator Obama was asked a similar question, he said, quote, if al-Qaeda is forming a base in Iraq, then we will have to act in a way that secures the American homeland and our interests abroad. So I'm wondering if...
It's an interesting comment. If al-Qaeda is securing a al-Qaeda base... Yeah, well, that's exactly what they've been trying to do for the past 4 years. That's their stated intention, was to create enough chaos and disorder to establish a base from which to either launch attacks or spread a caliphate. And the intent of the surge was to send more Marines into the area where they had proclaimed their desire to set up a base. That was Anbar province. And so, that's one of the challenges we face is denying al-Qaeda a safe haven anywhere. And their intentions, that's what they said, that they would like to have a base or safe haven in Anbar province. Yeah, Bill.
Nice try. Mr. President.
You obviously hadn't been here long. John, where have you been, Jonathan?
Across the river.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
All right.
Welcome to the other side.
If you can get the Congress to protect telecom companies from lawsuits, then there's no recourse for Americans who feel that they've been caught up in this. I know it's not intended to spy on Americans, but in the collection process, information about everybody gets swept up and then it gets sorted. So if Americans don't have any recourse, are you just telling them when it comes to their privacy to suck it up?
I wouldn't put it that way if I were you in public, Bill. I mean, you've been around long enough to... Anyway, yeah. If people who analyze the program fully understand that America's civil liberties are well protected. There is a constant check to make sure that our civil liberties of our citizens aren't, are treated with respect. And that's what I want, and that's what most Americans, all Americans want. Now, let me talk about the phone companies. You cannot expect phone companies to participate if they feel like they're going to be sued. I mean, these people are responsible for shareholders. They're private companies. The government said to those who have alleged to have helped us that it is in our national interest and it's legal. It's in our national interest because we want to know who's calling who. From overseas into America, we need to know in order to protect the people. It was legal. And now, all of a sudden, plaintiff's attorneys, class action plaintiff's attorneys, I don't want to try to get inside their head. I suspect they see, a financial gravy train are trying to sue these companies. First, it's unfair. It is patently unfair. And secondly, these lawsuits create doubts amongst those who will whose help we need. I guess you could be relaxed about all this if you didn't think there was a true threat to the country. I know there's a threat to the country. And the American people expect our Congress to give the professionals the tools they need to listen to foreigners who may be calling into the United States with information that could cause us great harm. So on the one hand, the civil liberties of our citizens are guaranteed by a lot of checks in the system, scrutinized by the United States Congress. And secondly, I cannot emphasize to you how important it is that the Congress solve this problem. The Senate has solved the problem. And people say, would you ever compromise on the issue? The Senate bill is a compromise. And there's enough votes in the House of Representatives to pass the Senate bill. It's a bipartisan bill. And the House leaders need to put it on the floor. Let the will of the House work. My judgment happens to be the will of the people, to give the professionals the tools they need to protect the country. Blaine.
Mr. President, you've stressed over and over in recent days, particularly the importance of FISA reform to help keep America safe, and yet you have not yet filled a key national security post. Fran Townsend announced her resignation months ago in November. What is the delay there, and what are Americans to make of that delay? Is America less safe because of it?
We got a fine man named Joel Bagnell working that office right now. He's a professional. I trust his judgment. He's a real good guy. And no, they shouldn't worry about Joel. He knows what he's doing. John.
But sir, the American
John.
Homeland Security Advisor is a key post. What's the
Joel name? Bagnell is occupied the position, Elaine. He's doing the job, and I've got confidence in him, and so should the American people have confidence in him. He's a fine professional. He knows what he's doing. And I'm very comfortable in saying on your cameras that that our staff in the White House, led by Joel Bagnell, knows what they're doing when it comes to advising the president on matters of homeland security. John.
Thanks, Mr. President. There's been a lot of criticism on the campaign trail of free trade policies and even talk about the U.S. opting out of NAFTA. And it doesn't seem that you want to discuss the prospects of Republican candidates on the campaign trail this year, but
not yet.
But just given all the concerns about the economy that people have, do you feel like you could win in a state like Ohio if you were running again for presidency?
Landslide, right? No. I am a big believer in free trade, and the reason why is I firmly believe that free trade is essential to the formation of high-paying, quality jobs. In other words, people who work for industries that export goods to overseas, are likely to be paid more than their other workers. Secondly, if you look at our economic growth recently, particularly last year, a major portion of that growth came as a result of exports. It's an essential part of our economic picture. Yeah, I heard the talk about NAFTA. You know, one statistic I think people need to know is I think there's roughly like $380 billion worth of goods that we ship to our NAFTA partners on an annual basis. Now, $380 billion worth of goods means there's a lot of farmers and businesses large and small who are benefiting from having a market in our neighborhood. And the idea of just unilaterally withdrawing from a trade treaty because of, trying to score political points is not good policy. It's not good policy on the merits, and it's not good policy as a message to send to our, people who have in good faith signed a treaty and worked with us on a treaty. Thirdly, those of us who grew up in Texas remember what the border looked like when we were kids. And it was really poor. And you go down to that border today, it is prosperous on both sides of the river, to the credit of those who proposed NAFTA and to the credit of those who got NAFTA through the Congress. If you're worried about people coming into our country illegally, it makes sense to help a place like Mexico grow its economy. Most folks would rather be finding a job close to home. Most folks would rather not try to get, in the bottom of an 18-wheeler to come and put food on the table. This agreement has meant prosperity on both sides of our borders, north and south. And I believe it's in the interest to continue to seek markets for our farmers, ranchers, and business people. I also know it's in our interest to insist that when people sell products into our countries, that we get treated fairly. In other words, if we treat a country one way, people in a country one way, we expect to be treated the same way, like Colombia. The Colombia Free Trade Vote's coming up. Many of their products come into our country much easier than our products go into theirs. It makes sense to be treated equally. But on this vote, there's an additional consequence. If the Congress rejects the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, it will sorely affect the national security interests of the United States. It will encourage false populism in our neighborhood. It will undermine the standing of courageous leaders like President Uribe. And I strongly urge the Congress, when they bring this, when the Colombia Free Trade Agreement is brought to a vote, to seriously consider the consequences of rejecting this trade agreement. Mike.
Mr. President, on FISA, do you worry that perhaps some House Democratic leaders are playing a high-stakes game of wait and see in terms of if we get attacked, we all lose? If we don't get attacked, then maybe that makes the case that you don't need all the powers in FISA?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's that would be ascribing, motives that are... I just don't think they're the motives of the House leaders to do that. I think they're really wrestling with providing liability protection to phone companies. I don't think they're that cynical or devious, Michael. It's just too risky. A lot of these leaders understand that there is an enemy that wants to attack. The caucus, evidently, in the House, the Democrat caucus, is concerned about exactly Plant's question, And I just can't tell you how important it is to not alienate or not discourage these phone companies. How can you listen to the enemy if the phone companies aren't going to participate with you? And they're not going to participate if they get sued. Let me rephrase, less likely to participate. And they're facing billions of dollars of lawsuits, and they have a responsibility to their shareholders. And yet they were told what they were going to do is legal. And I'm going to keep talking about the issue, Mike. This is an important issue for the American people to understand. And it's important for them to understand that no renewal of the Patriot Act, the Protect America Act, is dangerous for the security of the country. just dangerous. I'm sure people, if they really pay attention to the details of this debate, wonder why it was okay to pass the Protect America Act last summer, late last summer, and all of a sudden it's not okay to pass it now. And so I will keep keep talking about the issue and talking about the issue. Michael.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to ask you about another issue that's kind of come up on the campaign trail in terms of discussion, which is this is a point of view that has been espoused that we would be better off if we talked to our adversaries, in particular Iran and Cuba, you know, without preconditions. Mm-hmm. And as president, you've obviously considered and rejected this approach. And I'm wondering if you can, you know, give us a little bit of insight into your thinking about this and just explain to the American people what is lost by, you know, talking with those with whom we disagree.
What's lost by embracing a tyrant who puts his people in prison because of their political beliefs? What's lost is it'll send the wrong message. It'll send a discouraging message to those who wonder whether America will continue to work for the freedom of prisoners. It'll give great status to those who have suppressed human rights and human dignity. You know, I'm not suggesting there's never a time to talk, but I'm suggesting now is not the time not to talk with Raul Castro. He's nothing more than an extension of what his brother did, which was to ruin an island and imprison people because of their beliefs. These wives of these dissidents come and see me, and their stories are just unbelievably sad. And it just goes to show how, you know, how repressive the Castro brothers have been when you listen to the truth about what they say. And the idea of embracing a leader who's done this without any attempt on his part to, you know, release prisoners and free their society would be counterproductive and send the wrong signal.
But no one is saying embrace them.
Well, talking to him is embracing. Excuse me. Let me use another, you know, another word. You're right. Embrace is like big hug, right? That's you're looking. I do embrace people, Mike. One of these days, I'm just thinking about. right. Okay. Good. Thank you for reminding me to use a different word. Sitting down at the table, having your picture taken with a tyrant such as Raul Castro, for example, lends the status of the office and the status of our country to him. He gains a lot from it by saying, look at me, I'm now recognized by the President of the United States. Now, somebody would say, well, I'm going to tell him, you know, to release the prisoners. Well, it's a theory that all you got to do is embrace and these tyrants act. That's not how they act. That's not what causes them to respond. And so I made a decision quite the opposite, and that is to keep saying to the Cuban people, we stand with you. We will not, you know, sit down with your leaders that imprison your people because of what they believe. We will keep an embargo on you. We do want you to have money from people here in the homeland, but we will stay insistent upon this policy until you begin to get free. And so that's the way I've conducted foreign policy and will continue to conduct foreign policy. I just remind people that the decisions of the U.S. president to have discussions with certain international figures can be extremely counterproductive. It can send chilling signals and messages to our allies. It can send confusion about our foreign policy. It discourages reformers inside their own country. And in my judgment, it would be a mistake on the two countries you talked about. Cheryl.
Thank you. I want to bring you back to Senator Obama's comment on Iraq. Do you believe that his comment was naive?
I believe Senator Obama better stay focused on his campaign with Senator Clinton, neither of whom has secured their party's nomination yet. And my party's nomination hadn't been decided yet either. And so there'll be ample time to discuss whoever their candidate, the positions, whoever their candidate is. Nice try, Cheryl. Would you like to try another tack?
You said it was another
question.
Comment. Okay, I'll follow on it. About Iraq, you have said in the past that you want to leave a sustainable policy.
Yeah.
You said I could have another question.
That's good, yeah, okay.
You want to leave your
well,
policy.
Well, it was just another question. Give her a... Should we vote on whether she gets another question?
They're for me. You've said, Mr. President, that you want to leave Iraq in a sustainable situation at the end of your administration. Can you describe for us specifically, what do you mean by sustainable? Do you have specific goals and objectives that, in your mind, would meet the criteria of sustainability?
Which is to keep enough troops there so we can succeed. And David Petraeus will come, as for example, David Petraeus will come back along with Ryan Crocker here later on this spring, and we'll make a recommendation as to what those troop levels ought to be. The idea of having a request by the Iraqi government for a long-term security agreement is part of sustainability. And obviously, we're going to be pushing hard at the same time to get the political process moving forward. I don't know if you noticed yesterday, but it was a very interesting moment in Iraqi constitutional, you know, constitutional history when part of the a member of the Presidency Council utilized his constitutional right to veto one of the three pieces of legislation recently passed. I understand the use of the veto and intend to continue to use it, and I thought it was a healthy sign that, you know, people are thinking through the legislation that's passed and they're worrying about making sure that laws are constitutional. And I feel pretty good about the fact that they're, of course, going to continue to work to make sure that their stated objective of getting provincial elections done by October of 2008 will happen. So there's going to be a lot of work. My only point is sustainability is political, economic, and security. Yeah, Ed.
Good morning, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
Get back to the economy. The GDP numbers today show that our economy is increasingly relying on U.S. exports to keep growing. How important is a competitive dollar in keeping U.S. exports strong and growing?
We believe in a strong dollar policy, and we believe that, and I believe that our economy has got the fundamentals in place for us to be a, is to grow and continue growing more robustly, you know, hopefully than we're growing now. And the dollar, the value of the dollar will be reflected in the ability for our economy to be, to grow economically. And so we're still for a strong dollar.
Can I follow up on that, sir?
Maybe. I guess you are. Yeah, I didn't say yes, but please.
What's your advice to the average American who is hurting now, facing the prospect of $4 a gallon gasoline, a lot of people facing...
Wait, what did you just say? You're predicting $4 a gallon gasoline?
A number of analysts are predicting $4 a gallon gasoline this spring when they reformulate.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I know it's high now.
And the other economic problems facing people beyond your concern that you stated here and your expectations for these stimulus checks, what kind of hope can you offer to people?
Keep the tax cuts permanent, for starters. There's a lot of economic uncertainty. You just said that. You just said the price of gasoline may be up to $4 a gallon, or some expert told you that. And that creates a lot of uncertainty. If you're out there wondering whether or not, you know, what your life is going to be like, and you're looking at $4 a gallon, that's uncertain. And when you couple that with the idea that their taxes may be going up in a couple of years, that's double uncertainty. And therefore, one way to deal with uncertainty is for Congress to make the tax cuts permanent. Secondly, it's people got to understand that our energy policy needs to be focused on a lot of things. One, renewables, which is fine, which I strongly support, as you know. Two, conservation. But we need to be finding more oil and gas at home if we're worried about becoming dependent on oil overseas. And this, I view it as a transitory period to new technologies that will change the way we live. But we haven't built a refinery in a long time. We're expanding refineries, but we haven't built a refinery in a long time. I strongly suggested to the Congress that we build refineries on old military bases. But no, it didn't pass. But if you've got less supply of something, as demand continues to stay steady or grow, your price is going to go up. Secondly, on oil, the more oil we find at home, the better off we're going to be in terms of the short run. And yet our policy is, you know, let us not explore robustly in places like Anwar and there are environmental concerns, and I understand that. I also know there's technologies that should mitigate these environmental concerns. I've got a bill up there in Congress now. Their attitude is, let's tax oil companies. Well, all that's going to do is make the price even higher. We ought to be encouraging investment in oil and gas close to home if we're trying to mitigate the problems we face right now. And so, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, and I'm concerned about the uncertainty. Hopefully this, you know, this pro-growth package will help. This $147 billion will be going out the door, starting electronically in the first week of May and through check in the second week of May. And the idea is to, you know, help our consumers deal with the uncertainty you're talking about. But, yeah, no question about it. It's a difficult period. Yeah, Kim.
Thank you, sir. Now that you've found a location for your presidential library, you've got to find the money to build it. Reports indicate that you may be trying to collect as much as $200 million. Is that figure accurate? Do you believe it's important for the American people to know who is giving that kind of money to their president? Will you disclose the contributions as they come in, and will you place any restriction on who gives money and how much they can give?
No, yes, no, yes. First question. I haven't, man, you obviously haven't asked a question in a long time. It's like, you know, I haven't seen the final budget. Two, as Donnie Evans said, who's the chairman of the foundation, we'll look at the disclosure requirements and make a decision. Here's the, there's a lot of people, or some people, I shouldn't say a lot, some people who like to, you know, like to give and don't particularly want their names disclosed, whether it be for this foundation or any other foundation. And so we'll take that into consideration. Thirdly, and what was the other?
Any restrictions on who can give? Will you take foreign money for this?
Yeah, probably take some foreign money, but don't know yet, Ken. We just announced the deal, and I frankly have been focused elsewhere, like on gasoline prices and, you know, my trip to Africa, and haven't seen the fundraising strategy yet. And so the answer to your question, really, I can't answer your question.
Where does people's right to know this fit into all of that?
We're weighing, taking a look, taking consideration, giving up serious consideration. Nice try, though. Olivier.
Thank you, sir. In China, a former factory worker who says that human rights are more important than the Olympics is being subversion. What message does it send that you're going to the Olympics, and do you think athletes there should be allowed to publicly express their dissent?
Olivier, I made it very clear I'm going to the Olympics because it's a sporting event, and I'm looking forward to seeing the athletic competition, but that will not preclude me from meeting with the Chinese president, expressing my deep concerns about a variety of issues, just like I do every time I meet with the president. And now, maybe I'm in a little different position. Others don't have a chance to visit with Hu Jintao, but I do. And every time I meet with him, I talk about religious freedom and the importance of China's society recognizing that if you're allowed to worship freely, it'll benefit the society as a whole, that the Chinese government should not fear the idea of people praying to a god as they see fit. A whole society, a healthy society, a confident society is one that recognizes the value of religious freedom. I talk about Darfur and Iran and Burma. And so I am not the least bit shy bringing up the concerns expressed by this factory worker, and I believe that I'll have an opportunity to do so with the president. And at the same time, enjoy a great sporting event. I'm a sports fan. I'm looking forward to the competition. And each Olympic society will make its own decision as to how to deal with the athletes. Yeah, Mark.
Mr. President, back to the oil price tax breaks that you were talking about a minute ago. Back when oil was $55 a barrel, you said those tax breaks were not needed. People had plenty of incentive to drill for oil. Now the price of oil is $100 a barrel, yeah. And you're planning to threaten a plan that would shift those tax breaks to renewables.
I talk about some of the breaks. And this generally is a tax increase. And it doesn't make any sense to do it right now. We need to be exploring for more oil and gas. And taking money out of the coffers of the oil companies will make it harder for them to reinvest. I know they say, well, look at all the profits. Well, we're raising the price of gasoline in a time when the price of gasoline is high. Secondly, we've invested a lot of money in renewables. This administration has done more for renewables than any president. Now, we got a problem with renewables, and that is the price of corn is beginning to affect, food, cost of food, and, you know, it's hurting hog farmers and a lot of folks. And the best way to deal with renewables is to focus on research and development that will enable us to use other raw material to produce ethanol. I'm a strong believer in ethanol, Mark. And this administration's got a great record on it. But it is a... I believe research and development is what's going to make renewable fuels more effective. Again, I repeat, if you look at what's happened in corn out there, you're beginning to see the food issue and the energy issue collide. And so, to me, the best dollar spent is to continue to deal with cellulosic ethanol in order to deal with this bottleneck right now. And secondly, I said that a while ago, on certain aspects, but the way I analyze this bill is it's going to cost the consumers more money. And we need more oil and gas being explored for. We need more drilling. We need less dependence on foreign oil. And so, as I say, we're in a period of transition here in America from a time where we are oil and gas dependent to hopefully a time where we got electric automobiles and we're spending money to do that, a time when we're using more biofuels and we've taken huge investments in that. A time when we've got nuclear power plants and we're able to deal with the disposal in a way that brings confidence to the American people, so we're not dependent on natural gas to fire up a lot of our utilities. And a time when we can sequester coal. That's where we're headed for, but we've got to do something in the interim. Otherwise, we're going to be dealing, as the man said, with $4 gasoline. And so that's why I'm against that bill. I thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sir,
enjoy being with you. Pardon me?
You said that Hillary Clinton will be the nominee?
I'm not talking about politics.
You said that before, though.
I'm trying to get me to be punted in chief.
Commander-in-chief.
I appreciate you very much. Jackson, but nice to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Neil Conan. You've been listening to special coverage of a presidential news conference from NPR News. And the president opened, as expected, with a couple of comments, one relating to his recent visit to Africa, but also more pointedly scolding Congress, for particularly the House of Representatives, for failure to pass the new FISA law, the Protect America Act, and we'll discuss that in just a moment. The president also was asked several times to seemingly join the conversation on the campaign trail. In general, he declined to be drawn on the various debates, but he did say that he thought Senator Obama's remarks about al-Qaeda and a base in Iraq were interesting. He was asked a lot of questions about the economy, and he was said that the country has the fundamentals for growth, but he did say there's no question there's slower growth now. He said he did not believe they would go into a recession, and was asked several times about the price of oil and gasoline and various bills in Congress and tax proposals, but he basically said we need more drilling in this country. There should be economic concerns, of course, but also environmental concerns in places like Anwar, the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, and he said technologies should alleviate some of those concerns. Asked on foreign affairs, he agreed with Secretary of Defense Robert Gates that Turkey should make its incursion into northern Iraq brief, and he also talked about what many regarded as a setback in political developments yesterday in Iraq, the defeat of a provincial elections bill, and he said, well, this was the first use of a veto under their constitution. He saw it as a healthy sign politically. With me are Tom Jelton, NPR's intelligence correspondent, David Wellner, NPR's congressional correspondent, and joining us is economics correspondent John Itzde. And John, let me ask you about the stimulus package that the president was asked about and what he hopes to do to get the sluggish economy moving again.
Well, the president expressed confidence in the stimulus package that was passed relatively quickly at the end of the year. And signed by him early this year. He said checks would be in the mail by the second week in May, and if you get your check at your bank through a credit, it'll be there in the first week in May. He said people could look forward to letters being sent out shortly to inform them whether they're eligible. He said he's not really interested in stimulus 2, which has been being talked about up on the Hill. He says let's give this first stimulus package, which sends rebates to people a chance to work, first of all.
And let's go to Capitol Hill now and to David Wellner. And David, it will have caught the attention of the Democrat leaders in the House of Representatives that the president was pounding the lectern as he called for a renewal of the Protect America Act, as it's now called, again on this issue of lawsuits and telephone companies.
Yes, he was certainly exercised about this. In fact, he said it's dangerous for the country that the House has not taken the bill the Senate passed that has immunity for the phone companies and passed it rather than working out a compromise with the Senate and agreeing on a mutually agreed upon bill. Now, one thing that I think is not very clear from what we heard from the press conference today, and that is that the phone companies can be compelled to cooperate with the government under current legislation. It really is not up to them to decide whether or not they want to cooperate. Under the law that was passed last August, any agreements that were made back then are in effect for the next year. If they have to go to some new phone company or carry out surveillance on some new target, they can go to the FISA court. They can do it 72 hours after they begin that surveillance and get permission. The FISA court, out of 23,000 requests over the last 30 years, has denied 5 requests. And so, in a sense, I think that the president is saying that the country is in danger, and yet Democrats are saying, we don't believe it, because, in fact, you actually can compel the phone companies to work with you.
Tom Gelton, let me turn to you now. And there were several questions trying to draw the president's interest in the presidential contest that's currently underway. He did remark, well, these contests are not over yet in either the Democratic or Republican parties. Nevertheless, he was asked about Senator Obama's remarks recently about meeting with foreign leaders without preconditions, and said, basically, if you're talking about Cuba and Iran, this would be a bad idea.
He sure did. And that was one of the points, Neil, where he did get quite emotional. He has, as he said, met with the wives of some Cuban dissidents. And even though he later in the press conference talked about the advantages of sitting down with the Chinese president, Hu Jintao.
And the advantages of sitting down with Vladimir Putin.
He emphasized the importance of having personal relations, a leader-to-leader relationship between the head of the president of the United States and the president of Russia. But Cuba just doesn't rank along with those other countries in terms of strategic U.S. interests. And so the president of the United States is free to look at the issue of engaging with the leader of Cuba on a narrower basis, strictly on the basis of human rights. And he felt very strongly, he said, that to sit down and have your picture taken with someone like Raul Castro would be to lend the status of his presidency, of his office, and of the United States to Raul Castro, and that would be inappropriate.
And John Itzde, another issue that's come up on the campaign trail has been NAFTA trade agreements in general, but NAFTA in particular. The Democrats in Ohio have been especially critical of that, and the president made a spirited defense of NAFTA.
Very spirited defense of NAFTA. He said if you go down to the border where he grew up, and you'll see that the border is much more prosperous on both sides now than it was before NAFTA, and he suggested that there was growth in the Mexican economy, although I think that might be alleviating some of the immigration problem, but I think there's a lot of thought that that NAFTA has really hurt Mexican farmers, and part of our immigration problem is that farmers are moving off the land there and trying to find work up here.
Mexico, of course, a major oil producer, too. The price of oil has gone up. But what about those predictions of $4 a gallon for gasoline?
Well, the president didn't seem to have read the newspaper in the last couple of days, but people have been predicting $4 a barrel oil. And the president's solution is
$4 a gallon gas.
We've got $100 barrel oil. The president's solution is to drill more in the United States. He acknowledged that's just a transitional thing and we've got to get biofuels going. But right now he thinks we just have to drill more in the United States, more domestic oil.
NPR economic correspondent John Itzde. Also, our thanks to Tom Gelton, NPR's intelligence correspondent. Both of them were here with me in Studio 3A. NPR's congressional correspondent David Wellner was with us from Capitol Hill. Stay tuned to NPR News for further coverage of these and other stories that will emerge from the president's news conference today. Again, he spoke especially about his visit to Africa and about the need for a new Protect America Act from the House of Representatives. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News.